Our keynote speaker today needs no introduction, as he is a familiar name to anyone who writes on Jerusalem or on the Arab-Israeli dispute more generally. Mick Dumper is a professor in Middle East politics at the University of Exeter in the United Kingdom, a prolific author and a frequent visitor to Jerusalem, where he has undertaken much of his research. He also has a connection to Singapore, which I will let him explain in his talk. One of the things I admire most about Professor Dumper's work is his knowledge and detail of events happening on the ground in Jerusalem, and I was pleased to see that his work has been cited in some of the papers that will be presented today. When I was last in Jerusalem about 8 months ago, I interviewed Sheikh Azam al-Khatib, the head of the Jordanian Waqf, for the paper that I'll be presenting on Jordan's role in Jerusalem this afternoon. After I finished the interview, one of his advisors told me that it would be a good idea if I also spoke to Professor Dumper. Clearly, Professor Dumper is held in the highest regard. So I'm pleased to say that not only have I been able to speak to Professor Dumper, we met again yesterday, but I'm delighted to be in the position of being able to invite him back to Singapore to give our keynote lecture. Thank you.
Thank you, Victor, and thank you, Michelle. Can you hear me? Is that clear? And good morning to everybody, and I'm very pleased to be here. It's a great honor and great pleasure for me to give this keynote address, and I'm very much looking forward to the discussions that we're going to have later today. And the invitation is especially meaningful to me for personal reasons. Part of my childhood was spent in Singapore when my father was the Dean of St. Andrew's Cathedral, and I am an old boy of St. Andrew's School. And as the only European pupil in the school, it provided me with friends and experiences which have been the foundation stone of my outlook on the world. The school's multi-ethnic, multi-confessional, and multicultural environment was an important example of how humans from very different backgrounds and beliefs can study and work and live together. And that experience has driven my quest for understanding the causes of the conflict in the city which is the focus of this conference, Jerusalem. So why should Jerusalem be of interest to Singapore? This was a question posed to me when I first mentioned the invitation to colleagues. And I think it is apt to just touch on this briefly in my introduction as a way of focusing our minds on the relevance of this conference. In the first place, we should note that Singapore lives in a politically dynamic and multi-confessional region with an astonishing cross-section of beliefs and values. In many cases, these beliefs and values are expressed in political and sometimes quite militant terms. For example, to the east of Singapore, we have the activities of the Abu Sayyaf group in the Philippines. Just to the west and south, there is Indonesia, the most populous Muslim country in the world. To Singapore's north, there's a revival of Salafi-inspired activism in Malaysia. There's Buddhist-Muslim tensions in Myanmar, and an increasingly Arabized South Indian Muslim community emerging in Kerala. And finally, an outbreak of Muslim-Christian tensions in Sri Lanka. And this is a volatile mix of religion, ethnicity, and national identity, often waiting to erupt into political violence. And the religious dimensions of these tensions also brings the role of Jerusalem as a holy city even more to the fore. So what happens in the Middle East and in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict contributes to this volatility. Therefore, there is a need for academics and policymakers to keep an eye on the region and on developments on the region and on developments in Jerusalem in order to be able to preempt some of the issues that might be emerging. Can I just see if this slide works? Yeah. Well, my is my slides on it? Oh yeah, here you are. Okay, great. No. There you are. Great, thank you. Here is a a collage of slides of holy sites in Jerusalem. Jerusalem is crammed full with religious sites and associated buildings, and this has played a key part in framing the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. The most important religious sites of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam are to be found sometimes on top of each other and in what is a relatively small city. For Judaism, the Temple Mount is the primary site and comprises the ruins of what is known as the First and Second Temples. The Wailing or Western Wall is now the only visible reminder of their destruction in 70 CE. Located on the Temple Mount is also the site of the Holy of Holies of the Israelite tribes, presided over by a priestly elite. For Muslims, the exact same site is the Haram al-Sharif, or the Noble Sanctuary, and it is one of the three holiest sites in Islam, the other two being Mecca and Medina. It contains the Dome of the Rock, where the Prophet Muhammad is believed to have briefly ascended to heaven, and Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is the direction that the first Muslims prayed to before there was a decision to face Mecca. In Islam, the Wailing Wall is known as Al-Buraq in Arabic and is believed to be the site where the Prophet Muhammad tied his horse during his ascension to heaven. Nearby is the Holy Sepulchre, the preeminent Christian holy site which marks Golgotha, where Jesus Christ is believed to have been crucified after his final walk along the Via Dolorosa, which runs through most of the city. And in this way, Jerusalem is not just holy to one religion, but is holy to three. And not only are these three religions the main monotheistic religions of the world, but they have emerged from each other's traditions and cultures and have elements of doctrine and ritual that both overlap and are embedded in each other. And in this way, layer upon layer of faith and belief has been deposited upon the city. Having lived and visited the city many times since 1977, I have become so accustomed to this plurality of faiths and the variety of rituals on the streets that it is often easy to overlook this uniqueness. When I look at the names of the other presenters of this conference, I'm quite humbled by the array of expertise and scholarship. And Victor has carried out a very commendable job in assembling such a team. As someone who does a lot of conferences, it's not easy to bring such a disparate group together. In his invitation, Victor suggested that my presentation should include an overview of some of the key developments in Jerusalem, in order to both set the scene for the subsequent papers, but also to provide others who are less familiar with Jerusalem an acquaintance with the broad sweep of its modern history and politics. While I will be faithful to Victor's suggestion, I think it is useful to start with a snapshot of where we are now, that is the current situation, which will give us a strong idea of why Jerusalem continues to be a key issue in understanding the conflicts of the Middle East in the region. Following from Victor's introduction about the move of the embassy, the US embassy. In December 2017, the US government announced that its embassy to Israel was to be relocated from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And in doing so, it would recognize Jerusalem as the capital of the State of Israel. This was a momentous decision whose consequences are still being played out today. As Victor said, until this announcement, the US embassy, together with every other embassy in Israel and Singapore's, was located in Tel Aviv and not in Jerusalem. This comprehensive diplomatic boycott by the international community was a sign that it did not recognize the city as the capital of Israel and that its future governance was still subject to negotiations. The reasons for the position taken by the international community will become apparent later in the presentation. But at this stage, I just wish to highlight two important effects of this dramatic change in US policy. Could I just have my the first effect was the damage done to the prospect of peace negotiations over the city in the near future. By recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital and by moving its embassy to the city, at a stroke, the US took the issue of Jerusalem off the negotiating table. Because of the central role played by the US in the peace negotiations, the US decision preempted the possibility of a Palestinian counterclaim to the city being considered, and consequently nullified the purpose of those negotiations. The second impact was to remove the US as a potential broker for any agreement between Israel and the PLO. As important as these two effects is also the fact that the US decision postponed negotiations over other important issues. There could be no agreement on these other important issues if there wasn't an agreement on Jerusalem. And to many experts and observers of the Jerusalem issue, the US decision was confusing, and the lack of clarity over the geographical term, what was termed Jerusalem. What did they mean? The announcement specified that the US was taking, in inverted commas, no position on boundaries or borders. But what did this mean? Did this mean that the US recognized Israeli sovereignty over both Israeli West Jerusalem and Palestinian East Jerusalem? And if so, then which borders in East Jerusalem was it recognizing as the part of the capital of the State of Israel? Scholars of Jerusalem will point out that there are quite a few boundaries, walls, barriers, and borders, and not all of them are congruent with each other. So what was the US actually recognizing? Which parts of Jerusalem were to be regarded as part of Israel? So at this point, we need to wind back a bit to the beginning and show how this lack of clarity is important and how it arose in the first place. And this will be the focus of most of my presentation. The theme running through the presentation, it will be the fluidity of the borders of the city as it rapidly expanded in the 20th century and as it was contested by Palestinian and Israeli nationalism. My overall contention is that Jerusalem has been a city of many borders, which simultaneously led to many challenges to policymakers, but it also offered up some opportunities for accommodation between the parties. I apologize to the Jerusalem experts here. I'm just doing a quick potted history for the next few minutes just to for the general audience. So in 1922, following the defeat of the Turkish forces in the First European War, the British mandate for Palestine was recognized by the international community. A key British policy that was fundamentally at odds with the Palestinian goal of independence was the policy to advance a Jewish national home in Palestine that had been initiated by the Balfour Declaration of 1917. And that declaration was incorporated into the terms of the British mandate. Jerusalem, with its many iconic religious sites, as well as its role as the center of the colonial government, became one of the stages on which Palestinian and Jewish, and then later Israeli nationalisms fought. The rapid expansion expansion of Jerusalem outside the walls of the city, and hence its boundaries and borders, began with the establishment of the British Mandate. New employment opportunities in government and municipal service drew in Palestinians from the hinterland, and the increased flow of Jewish settlers as a result of the Jewish National Home Policy led to extreme congestion in the city. New neighborhoods were created, mostly in the west of the city, and roads to the surrounding villages were improved, which brought them into the city's orbit even further. As a result, the British introduced a series of extensions to the city's municipal borders. And I wish here to fast forward to the narrative of 1948 to draw your attention to the partitioning of Jerusalem, which was one of the most important events in the city's modern history. Without entering into too many details, which will be discussed later today, the British mandate proved impossible to sustain in the face of growing Jewish immigration and the clamor of both Palestinian and Jewish communities for an independent state. In 1947, the United Nations proposed a partition of Palestine into three entities, a Jewish state, an Arab state, and a temporary international zone. Oops. A Jewish state, an Arab state, and an international zone. The international zone for Jerusalem was never established. Following the outbreak of fighting between Palestinian Arab and Jewish communities, the British withdrew from Palestine in May 1948, and the city was divided between what became known as Israeli West Jerusalem and Palestinian East Jerusalem. It is a division which lasted 19 years until the Israeli takeover of East Jerusalem in 1967. It is also a division which left its scars on the city to this day, and where it is still possible to identify physical markers and architectural and cultural differences between the two sides of the city. All of the Palestinian population in the western neighborhoods of Jerusalem fled to the eastern side. Similarly, all the Jewish population in the Old City and in the enclaves adjacent to the Old City fled into the areas held by the new state of Israel. The dividing line ran along the western edge of the Old City before curling back to the coast. And this became known as the famous Green Line. And during this period of division, the municipal area of East Jerusalem fell under the control of the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan and was slightly enlarged to incorporate a number of villages. Similarly, a new municipality was established in West Jerusalem, also with new and larger borders. In 1967, Israel occupied the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, which ostensibly meant that a single polity was once again in charge of the whole city. The Israeli state rapidly moved to incorporate East Jerusalem and additional adjacent parts of the West Bank into a new and greatly enlarged Israeli Jerusalem municipal area. And you can see the line going all the way up there, up to Ramallah and down to Bethlehem. However, despite enormous investments in these acquired areas, it not only failed to completely repair the slash running through the heart of the city, but its policies also engendered a whole series of new divisions and sub-political borders in the city. And it is at this point that one can most clearly see how Jerusalem became a city of many borders. There are a number of reasons for this, and I shall just address a couple. The first main issue is that of demography and residential segregation. As you can see from the slides, the implantation of Israeli settler colonies in East Jerusalem has been a huge and comprehensive exercise. The blue are the settler colonies. This exercise has been designed to ensure both the physical separation of East Jerusalem from its West Bank hinterland, and also to bind those colonies and the territory they are built upon to the Israeli state, through infrastructure, through services, and through a separate legal system. Much of this land was belonged to the Palestinians or to non-Israeli institutions, and that is a topic for another lecture. But the essential feature of these colonies is not just their forbidding quasi-military configurations, but they are legally reserved for Israeli Jews. I have some pictures. Here's a Palestinian Hizma in the background, and Israeli Pisgat Zev, and the border running through the middle. And here's Hahoma from the village of, what's the village? Beit Zahur. The Palestinian Arabs of East Jerusalem, and even Palestinians with Israeli passports, are not permitted to live in these colonies. So in one single policy action, the whole of East Jerusalem is broken up into a series of enclaves, creating social, linguistic, religious, and educational, as well as political borders across a large part of the city. No decision has had a greater impact on the integrity of the city than this policy of residential segregation. The second driver in the fragmentation of the city is the Israeli quest for security in and around the city. Following the 1967 war, Israel was able to assert complete military dominance over the eastern parts of the city and its hinterlands. There have been many military operations and terrorist attacks carried out by the different Palestinian military and political groups, but these have been largely sporadic and short-lived campaigns before they were broken up. There has also been widespread public disorder, notably during the two Palestinian uprisings, or intifadas, stretching between 1987 and to 2006. Nevertheless, Israeli military dominance over East Jerusalem is not in doubt or under threat. At the same time, Israeli security concerns and policing operations has created a dual security system, which further divides the eastern part of the city into enclaves. From 1967 to 1993, for example, there was a security border which ringed East Jerusalem, but which was not congruent with the new municipal borders introduced in 67. Checkpoints and barriers were placed at key access points to the city, which were, in some cases, well inside the municipal borders. So I'll skip this slide. This is the showing the mixture, the enclaves, with the yellow being the Palestinian areas of residence and blue being being the Israeli ones. And this is the new wall that is circulating around. I'll come to that. But here's a picture of a barrier that's just actually outside the Hebrew University, between the Hebrew University and Isawiya village. And it's inside the middle of Jerusalem. From 1993 onwards, following the wave of attacks by Palestinian militants on Israeli military and civilian targets, a barrier, also known as the wall, was erected that ran between Israeli colonies and the more outlying areas of Palestinian residents, and this bore little relation to the municipal borders of the city. And that's the map I showed you here. So the dotted line is the municipal borders, and the dark line is the wall. Barrier. Thus, not only was East Jerusalem divided by policies of segregation, but it was further divided by policies which sought to enhance the security of Israeli residents. There are other examples which may not have had the same impact as the segregation and security policies mentioned above, but nonetheless have complemented the fragmentation those policies have brought to the city. These are referred to as the soft borders of the city. One example is that the water supplied by the northern Palestinian suburbs is actually piped in from Ramallah. The electrical power in Palestinian areas in East Jerusalem is supplied by a Palestinian company. So you have a situation in the capital of the State of Israel. Some services was supplied by institutions which are associated with Palestinians. So this is the water border, where the blue bits are, and this is the electricity border. A soft border. A final example of one of the soft borders of Jerusalem is in the realm of religion. As one might imagine, in a city so replete with religious institutions and religious history, the role of religious communities and their governing hierarchies plays an important role in the way the city is governed. These are powerful institutions which constrain the ability of the state to exercise its full sovereignty and jurisdiction in Jerusalem. In the period after 67, when Israel began its colonizing activities and extended its law over East Jerusalem, it made concessions to the Muslim and Christian religious establishments, which allowed a significant degree of autonomy in their internal administrative arrangements over their properties and their holy places. One should recall that significant parts of East Jerusalem, and in particular the Old City, are owned and administered by the churches, or an Islamic foundation known as the Waqf Administration. And since 1967, the Waqf Administration has continued to be funded by the Jordanian government, which also appoints most of the senior personnel. Thus, the Waqf Administration, a semi-autonomous administration employing several hundreds of people and carrying out significant building works, is managed by the Jordanian government and staffed by personnel loyal either to the PLO or to Hamas in the heart of the territory that Israel is claiming as its capital. So taken together cumulatively, these crisscrossing hard and soft borders combine to divide Jerusalem up into small pieces. There are enclaves and stretches of land or streets which operate under different legal jurisdictions, different policing rules of engagement, different educational curricula, but which are adjacent or in close proximity to each other. Now, in recent years, I have been comparing religious conflicts in cities in Europe and Asia in order to understand better the dynamics of conflict in Jerusalem. I carried out a comparison between the cities of Cordoba, Benares, Lhasa, Georgetown in Malaysia, and Jerusalem to examine their propensity to conflict over religious issues, and focusing on issues which were perhaps contrasting or similar to the situation in Jerusalem. Actually, this is another church of my father in Georgetown. Anyway, taken together cumulatively, amongst my findings were that religious conflicts in cities emanate where there are two or more religious communities which control holy sites which are central to their faith, or where there are powerful clerical hierarchies and where revenues accrue to those hierarchies independently of the state, and where they have strong international links either through a religious diaspora or through pilgrimage. Some religious conflicts are exacerbated by residential, educational, and employment segregation, and by policies which privilege one community over another. At the same time, religious conflicts can be ameliorated if the rule of law implemented by the sovereign power is recognized as broadly legitimate. So, for example, despite the rise of Hindu nationalist parties in India that have targeted Muslim mosques said to be built upon the ruins of Hindu temples, the legitimacy of the Indian state itself is not in question. And opposition to Hindu maximalist claims proceed broadly within the accepted legal framework. In the Jerusalem case, we can see clearly how the absence of a legitimacy constantly undermines the authority of the Israeli state in the conflicts over access and management of the holy sites, where it is seen to be privileging the interests of one community over the other. I'm conscious of the time, so I'm going to conclude my address, really. I want to peer a little bit into the future. At the beginning, I drew attention to how the US administration, through the unilateral actions regarding the Palestinian claims to East Jerusalem, has deferred the resumption of negotiations. Reflecting on the 2.5 decades since the Oslo Accords, we should ask ourselves, to what extent is the search for peace in the city, in the current context, a search for fool's gold? Surely we need to recognize that unless there is a dramatic shift in the current balance of power between Israel and the Palestinians, there can be little change in the ongoing low-level conflict situation. I would argue that this ongoing low-level conflict is based upon a trajectory in which Israel will gradually and steadily encroach upon non-Jewish holy sites and either gradually and steadily squeeze out the Palestinian population from East Jerusalem or gradually absorb them into Israel as second-class citizens. At the same time, however, this will not be a resolution of the conflict, and it will continue. This is because, although Israel can advance its position in Jerusalem with relative impunity, it is not able to take more far-reaching steps to completely neutralize Palestinian opposition and the international community's opposition to this advance. It is not able, for example, to act as ruthlessly as the Chinese government has done so in Lhasa, where the Tibetan Buddhist leadership, the religious institutions, the monasteries, and the holy sites are controlled by the Chinese state. For its part, Israel is not yet able to dismantle the religious institutions which constitute the Islamic and Christian presence, and thus the Palestinian presence in East Jerusalem. Similarly, its own internal political dynamics means that the contrasting prospect of Israel returning Palestinian property that it has acquired in East Jerusalem and recognizing Palestinian sovereignty there is also equally remote. So such an impasse means it is highly unlikely that there will be any semblance of a negotiated agreement over the city, and the conflict will remain ongoing for the foreseeable future, producing spikes of sporadic violence which are hastily and temporarily managed, but not ultimately resolved. Now, where does this leave countries like Singapore, lying in the midst of a region which will be affected by the continued impasse in Jerusalem and the Palestine-Israel conflict? What can countries like Singapore do? In the first place, conferences like this and institutions such as the Middle East Institute play a crucial role in keeping policymakers and the general public informed of possible instability that may emanate from the Middle East and affect its own backyard. One of the least welcome aspects of the conflict has been the way that ill-informed interventions by third parties have exacerbated and made more complicated the attempts of the key actors to come to an agreement. By supporting research and dissemination on the topic, Singapore can contribute to a greater understanding of its complexity. Secondly, encouraging a minimum adherence to the rule of law in international relations is crucial. An agreement between two parties that is equitable and just and which can be supported by the international community is a worthy aim in itself. But such a policy also has the additional value in that it will also place Singapore on a strong moral footing when it calls for similar adherence to international law in regional tensions closer to home. Thirdly, the example of Singapore as a multi-ethnic and multi-confessional society should not be undervalued or overlooked. The civil peace that has prevailed on the island since the shock of 1969 has not been achieved easily. There have been mistakes and disappointments along the way. But the lesson that the state should take an active role in creating policies and a public discourse that is inclusive and respectful of cultural difference is an important one that can be fruitfully shared with its allies, neighbours, and interested parties in the Middle East. So as you can see, studying Jerusalem raises all these issues and opens out so many avenues for debate and discussion. And I commend the Middle East Institute for organizing this event. Thank you.